You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodore's Obvious, Misfit, Sean, DJ Jesus 72, Lee, David, Torso and Pinches, Matt, the Snarlin' Sea Dog, Hangman Strain, John, Sir Rancid Cheese, Shelby, Andrew, Axios, Vanderwood, Richard, Noah, Infamous Florida Man, Hartman, Skipper, The Sextant, Brian, Cap'n Crunch, Roger the Jolly, Vibran, Artemis Killmeister, Keelhaul Chris, Carcos, Sean, Rotary Coast, MD, Seth, Ghost 750X, Lost Again, The Navigator, Vasios, Doc Lindsay, Pitluck, Ward, Workman, Chairboat, Gunsway Sally, Cannon Monkey, Rum Runner, Madam Anita Sparrow, Heyfei, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, The Snarlin' Sea Dog, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. When we left off, John Graham, Viscount Dundee, was raising a force of Scottish soldiers from his Highland regiments. This was the first Scottish Jacobite army intended to oppose the Convention of the Estates of Scotland and King William. Down in Edinburgh, things were extremely tense. That's where the convention was meeting, and there were throngs of angry men and women mobbing the streets. They were menacing the Jacobite garrison inside the castle. The convention, who was ostensibly on their side, and really just anyone who looked at them cross-eyed. It wouldn't be accurate to say that Edinburgh had fallen into a state of mob rule, of, you know, anarchy, but they were on a knife's edge, and it could happen at any moment. Throughout February and March of 1689, the convention debated and argued and sent a flurry of letters all over Europe. There were really two questions to be answered, although it was all kind of wrapped up in the same question. First, should they remove King James VII from the throne of Scotland? If they decided to remove King James from the throne, they would probably offer it to William and Mary. Not necessarily. There were other options, Scottish options, for the throne, descended from the line of Stuarts, and we'll talk about one of them today. These debates surrounding these two questions got pretty high-minded. There was a lot of early Enlightenment philosophy being kind of recklessly thrown around. They were talking John Locke, Francis Bacon, a bit of Calvin and Hobbes, but the main thinker from which they were pulling their ideas about the monarchy was a Scottish humanist named George Buchanan. And Buchanan had some pretty funny ideas about the monarchy. To boil it down, he saw the institution of monarchy as kind of a contractual relationship between the king or queen and the people. If the monarch failed to keep up their end of the bargain, the people were under absolutely no obligation to accept their rule. These were the same kind of debates they would be having in Philadelphia in about 80 years. And the convention here mostly agreed with what Buchanan had to say. So on the 4th of April, 1689, they took the decisive vote. They agreed that King James VII of Scotland had abdicated his responsibilities to the people of Scotland. When he fled Britain back in December, he had failed to do his duty. He broke the contract. As such, the throne now stood vacant. So that's the first question, but what about the second? Well, as we said, that was less certain. At first, there was a pretty decent amount of support for a union with England. This was pushed mainly by the Episcopalians in the convention. They wanted to ensure that the bishops would continue their role in charge of the Kirk. But it had some bipartisan support as well. There would have been serious economic benefits to this sort of thing. And it might even have been able to pass the convention. However, the Parliament of England just rejected the idea. They didn't want to do it, so that was off the table. So the convention delegates all looked around at one another and said, okay, well, I guess we're doing this ourselves, so why not just make ourselves a constitutional monarchy? They passed the Claim of Rights Act of 1689. See, whether or not William and Mary were going to get the throne, as I said, there were a couple other guys it could have been, but whoever was going to sit on the throne of Scotland, they wanted to make sure that they... Well, according to Tim Harris, in his book Revolution, they intended to, quote, bolster the position of Parliament within the Scottish Constitution at the expense of the royal prerogative, end quote. The Claim of Rights Act gave the Scottish Parliament the right to officially protest any royal decision and kind of left the door open for the possibility of a veto. They were also given the right to petition the Crown for anything they might need, and a big one for the Scottish was the right to overturn arrests or convictions that the Scottish Parliament deemed to be unlawful. There was some other stuff in there as well, but you get the idea. They were saying, these are our powers, and if you want to be king, you're going to have to respect that. They sent a copy down to London, and on the 11th of May, 1689, William and Mary agreed to the terms laid down in the Claim of Rights. That done, they formally accepted the crowns of Scotland. Now, there were still going to be quite a few debates to be had over the ecclesiastical future of Scotland. You know, Presbyterians or Episcopalians, bishops or presbyters, but the 1690 Act of Settlement would re-establish the Presbyterian leadership within the Scottish Kirk, and mostly that would put the question to bed. So they had their king, they had their church, everything was going great, right? Well, not quite yet. First, they had to deal with the Jacobites. This is episode 336, Bonnie Dundee. Remember William, Duke of Hamilton? He's the guy that was King William's personal nomination for the presidency of the convention. Well, he's going to play a role in the Parliament moving forward and help get that Act of Settlement passed, but he was getting on in years. For the most part, his political life was winding down. On the other hand, his eldest son, James Hamilton, was in the middle, at the height even, of a long and controversial political and military career. While the Convention of the Estates of Scotland was meeting and debating, and while William Hamilton was overseeing these debates, James Hamilton was imprisoned in the Tower of London. And I'd like to talk about his family tree for a second. Now, I know that can put some of you to sleep, but this family history actually plays a pretty major role in why the Pirates of Nassau, some of them at least, were doing what they were doing. If you want to talk about the early motivations of men like Henry Jennings and Charles Vane, this family tree is at the center of it. So I'm not going to spend forever on it, but we do need to cover it a bit. The Duke of Hamilton, William Hamilton, was not born a Hamilton at all. His family name was actually Douglas. He was born William Douglas. That's his father's name. But when he married his wife, Anne Hamilton, he adopted her name and her titles. Now, that might seem a bit odd, but in Scotland, it wasn't out of the ordinary. Women in Scotland could, and very often did, inherit the titles of their husbands or fathers or brothers. It was fairly common. And in this family history, it's going to play two major roles. See, Anne Hamilton could trace her lineage back to the King of Scotland, James II. Not to be confused with James II, King of England. Remember, in Scotland, he was James VII. This guy lived back in the 1400s, but he was a Stuart king, an ancestor of the current King James. His youngest daughter, Mary, was married off to the Earl of Arran at the age of 12. Her husband, the Earl of Arran, died when she was only 15. Now, she already had two kids, but she inherited his titles and his lands, making her the Countess Arran. Now, Mary was young and healthy and fertile and had the claim to a title of a large piece of land, not to mention her father was the king, so her hand in marriage was quite valuable. When she married for the second time, it was maybe the strongest political alliance she could have made. She married the first Duke of Hamilton. Now, this first Duke of Hamilton was about 40 years older than she was, pushing 60 at this point, so that's terrible. But he was the most powerful man in Scotland after the king. It made their family, the House of Hamilton, a political and military powerhouse. After they had a few children together, the House of Hamilton was recognized officially as a cadet branch of the House of Stuart. And in doing so, two major things were decided. First, should the House of Stuart fail, the House of Hamilton was to take up the throne of Scotland, kind of like the Bourbons down in France. They had the same deal. Second, the House of Hamilton was to serve as regent whenever the monarch was unable to fulfill their duties. When Mary, Queen of Scots, was down in France marrying the Dauphin, it was the House of Hamilton that sat the throne in her stead. When her son, James, was still in his minority, the House of Hamilton sat the throne in his stead. They took that duty seriously, and they were deeply loyal to the House of Stuart. But while that's an important insurance policy to have for a royal household, there's also kind of an implicit threat there as well. You know, we're here to help you out, but we're always going to be keeping our eyes open for a good opportunity. The civil wars in Britain and the Commonwealth under Cromwell were a tough time for the House of Hamilton. A lot of Hamilton men were either executed or killed in battle. In fact, when Charles was restored to the thrones of England and Scotland, the last surviving heir to the title and name of Hamilton was Anne. She was the Duchess Hamilton, maybe the most powerful person in Scotland, and maybe the most powerful woman in Britain, until Queen Mary comes along anyway. However, she was young and healthy and fertile, so she was expected to marry. Now, it would be almost impossible for her to marry up, unless she married a king, and there weren't any of those that would have made a good match. However, she did find a man who was a powerful earl with large swaths of land and a powerful military behind him. That was William Douglas. Now, William Douglas would take his wife's name, but he did not take her dynastic lineage. Should the question of regency come up, William would not become the regent. He didn't have that blood, but his wife, Anne, would. And when they had their first son, James, he would eventually be in that same position, a potential heir to the throne of Scotland, regent should it come up, and maybe a potential heir for the throne of England. That was less clear. I mean, it was the same family line that currently sat the throne of England, but did he have a right to it? Nobody seems to have really wanted to answer that question, though. You know, they kind of left it vague to keep their options open. But in 1685, when King Charles died, James Hamilton's name came up a lot. At the time, James was serving as the ambassador to France. This was an extremely important strategic position for a person in his position. It put him in direct and daily contact with King Louis of France. And Louis knew all of this, of course, and I'm certain that he was preparing James Hamilton to, if necessary, take up the throne of England. James' uncle, on his father's side, a man named George Douglas, Earl of Dumbarton, was also there in France. He was leading what was called Dumbarton's Regiment. The Dumbarton Regiment was a mercenary force of Scottish soldiers that was maybe the best Scottish army anywhere in Europe. But that's why he was in France. He was there, serving under King Louis at the behest of King James. And should the worst happen to James up in England, you know, say he were killed, that would put the best Scottish force anywhere in Europe in the hands of Louis, who also had a man who would be able to take up the throne of England and Scotland. Should the worst befall King James, the Earl Dumbarton would be able to put James Hamilton on the throne. But of course, that's not how it played out. James Hamilton was back in England in 1688. Now, I'm unclear on exactly why he was back in England. It may have been his own idea, you know, just got it into his head to cross the channel, but I think it's likely that it was his uncle's idea. See, James was a member, a senior member, of the Order of the Thistle, which was a Scottish chivalric order fiercely loyal to James II that had been founded by his uncle. I think he may have been sent to go, you know, aid James II, and you never know, in case the worst were to happen, he would be in place already. But King James did something that I don't think anybody really expected. When William of Orange landed, King James took flight. James Hamilton could have gone with him, but he didn't, which is another weird decision. I suspect that he had plans to go to Scotland. Maybe King James wanted James Hamilton to ride up north and lead the Scottish resistance, but before he could go, James Hamilton was arrested and thrown into the Tower of London. And then word was sent to Scotland of his arrest and imprisonment. And the crazy part here is that Duke William Hamilton and his wife Anne would almost certainly have found out that James was imprisoned from the very same courier that told them William Hamilton had been nominated by the same guy who arrested their son for the presidency of the convention. It's like, you know, hey, I just arrested your kid. Now I'd like you to go lead the delegation that's supposed to decide whether or not I'm going to be king. Make your decision wisely. I mean, that's diabolical. I love it. I'm sure it's pure coincidence that almost immediately after the convention decided to offer the crown to William and Mary, James Hamilton was released. However, he was not allowed to just, you know, ride off for Scotland. King William wanted James Hamilton right there where he could keep an eye on him. And for now, that ends his role in our little drama. Now, in the years to come, he's going to be an important figure. For example, James Hamilton is the man who's really leading the charge on the Darien scheme. He's its main proponent, one of its biggest investors. His mother is going to be an unofficial governor in the Bank of Scotland. You know, she's a woman, so I'm not sure it was really legal for her to be on the board, but she was also one of the biggest shareholders in the bank and one of the most powerful people on the island, so. But of course, the Darien scheme is going to fail, and that means that the Hamilton family is really going to take it in the teeth when some dastardly pirates steal the Speedy Return, and with it the hope of an independent Scotland. And then, a few years after that, when Queen Anne dies, James is going to be back in real contention to be King of England and Scotland. But for now, his Jacobite days seem to be behind him, so we're going to leave him there. Which means it's time to turn our eyes to the Scottish Highlands and the army of Viscount Dundee.
Napoleon Bonaparte rose from obscurity to become the most powerful and significant figure in modern history. Over 200 years after his death, people are still debating his legacy. He was a man of contradictions, a tyrant and a reformer, a liberator and an oppressor, a revolutionary and a reactionary. His biography reads like a novel, and his influence is almost beyond measure. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast, and every month I delve into the turbulent life and times of one of the greatest characters in history, and explore the world that shaped him in all its glory and tragedy. It's a story of great battles and campaigns, political intrigue, and massive social and economic change, but it's also a story about people, populated with remarkable characters. I hope you'll join me as I examine this fascinating era of history. Find The Age of Napoleon wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
The Latin word for good was bonus, or bone. It filtered down to French as bon, B-O-N-N-E, but we find it in a simplified form in common phrases like bonjour or bon appetit. The word made its way over to Britain, but from what I can tell, it didn't arrive through England. It seems to have come over from France during the reign of Mary, Queen of Scots, and it arrived first in Scotland. Now, I associate it today with the Irish, partly because this one Irish guy in a bar a few years back who kept hitting on my date by telling her how bonny she was. But mainly it's Anne Bonny. You know, she's Irish, fiery, red-haired, and pretty. And that's what bonny means in the Irish usage. Pretty, I mean, not the fiery redhead stuff. And in Scotland it also meant pretty, as well as good, but it was, I'm not sure if it was more often used for men than women, but it was commonly used on men. Think about Bonnie Prince Charlie, the grandson of James II, who's going to lead another Jacobite rebellion in 1745. Now, we're never going to talk about him, but before Bonnie Prince Charlie could run, Bonnie Dundee had to walk. James Graham, Viscount Dundee, was not yet known as Bonnie Dundee. That would be a posthumous nickname. But I mean, take a look at the guy's portrait and you can see how he got that nickname. I mean, I don't want to denigrate him and I don't want to suggest that what I'm about to say should be construed as denigration. It's just an observation here, no value judgment, but he looks like a girl. A pretty girl. He's got these pouty lips with a perfect little cupid's bow, long flowing chestnut locks, these big, blue, soft, sad eyes. Now, I doubt he actually looked how he does in that painting. and I kinda suspect the painter had a bit of a crush, but you can see why he'd earn a nickname that means pretty. But it wasn't an insult. You know, today, to call somebody a pretty boy, it's kind of an outdated insult, but it's seen as an insult. Now, there may have been a bit of a jab in there, but it was well meant, if so, and essentially, it's a compliment. However, at his military camp in spring 1689, I doubt he looked quite so feminine. At the very least, he wouldn't have been wearing his very expensive wig or his lace cravat. By May, around the time that William and Mary accepted their crowns, they would have had about 1,200 men at that army camp in the Highlands, which is not a great turnout. But there is one worthwhile conscript of note I want to mention. Robert Roy MacGregor. Now, if you know his story, or if you've seen the movie, you probably noted two of the lords we talked about last time, the Duke of Montrose and the Earl Argyll. They're going to be very important to Rob Roy later in his life. Now, he's not going to play a major role today. He's just another soldier serving in the army alongside his father, as it happened. But he is well known. So it's nice to be able to put a face and a name to the type of people that were going to be fighting for the Viscount Dundee. Rob Roy and his father were Highlanders. They were Episcopalians. Rob Roy himself, in fact, would later convert to Catholicism. And they were very rural people, not terribly well-educated, but not stupid either. Officially, their occupation was ranching. Unofficially, and in reality, their occupation was cattle rustling. We're talking, you know, Billy the Kid-style cattle thievery here. Their main game was a protection racket. They would be paid a fee by law-abiding cattle ranchers to stop cattle rustlers from stealing any of their cattle. If someone did steal their cattle, then they would go hunt them down and bring the cattle back. That was their job, and they did that job. But if you failed to pay up, somebody was going to steal that cattle. Now, no telling who it actually could have been, you know, a lot of dangerous people out there, but don't worry, find the money, and we'll go track it down. And once they did, within a couple of weeks, miraculously, they would bring the cattle back to you. But of course, they had nothing to do with stealing it. I mean, that would be illegal. And those are two pretty drastically different types of men we're talking about. When I picture this army, I picture 1,100 Rob Roys and maybe 100 dapper fops in command. Which is, you know, probably inaccurate, it's generalization, but that's what I see. And I do want to note here that Dundee, though I call him a dapper fop, and that might be a decent description, he was still one hell of a commander. Strategically and tactically, I wouldn't go so far as to call him brilliant, but definitely he was a man who could get the job done. Now, before Dundee even arrived on the scene, the army had already begun gathering at Glenroy, a place from which the Roy family got their name. They were roused initially by a man named Ewan Cameron of Clan Cameron. Ewan Cameron is often portrayed, usually by later romantic writers, as kind of a fierce, almost animalistic warrior. There's one story about a duel in which Cameron tore his opponent's throat out with his teeth. Probably not true, though maybe, but regardless, it paints a heck of a picture. And speaking of pictures, whoever painted his portrait definitely did not have a crush. He's got this creepy pencil-thin mustache and Gene Simmons hair and these beady little eyes. I mean, he is not a good-looking man, but he was regarded as one of the finest fighters in Scotland. Plus, he was huge, like a bear. I mean, there's one quote from a poem that was written later on that says he was, quote, unrivaled among the Celtic princes, end quote. By 1689, Ewan Cameron was getting on in years, but he had this brood of sons that were there with him, all of whom were as big or almost as big as he was. So, not to paint the Highlanders with a negative brush, but, I mean, imagine, you know, you've got a bunch of cattle-rustling cowboys and a bunch of giant animalistic bear monsters. It must have been quite a sight. And then Viscount Dundee rides in on his splendid steed with about 50 to 60 men who are all dressed just like him, well-off young noblemen. Together, Dundee and Ewan Cameron and a couple of their other lieutenants managed to pretty successfully do quite a bit of recruiting in the Highlands. Now, they only had about 3,500 men under their direct command, but there were a lot of people who weren't willing to serve full-time in this army they were building, but should they fight nearby, it was known that they were, you know, auxiliary forces in waiting. Meanwhile, down in Edinburgh, another army was mustering. The news of William and Mary's acceptance of the crown was brought to the convention by a man named Hugh Mackay. He had orders from the new king and queen, but he also had an army, the Scots Brigade. So we need to talk a bit about the Scots Brigade. The Scots Brigade were part of an Anglo-Scots mercenary force that served William of Orange under contract. Formerly, they had been commanded by the Duke of Monmouth. Under Monmouth, you had a number of lieutenants, but two of them are of particular note here: Hugh Mackay and John Graham, Viscount of Dundee. Dundee led a small, elite force of cavaliers. They were well-dressed, gallant horsemen who composed poetry and wooed damsels in lush groves at twilight. Mackay led the actual soldiers, the men who did the actual fighting, who sang bawdy songs in cheap taverns, and always had to pay for it. Around 1684, both the Duke of Monmouth and Viscount Dundee returned to Britain. Dundee went to London and Monmouth went to Scotland. Then in 1685, Monmouth led Monmouth's Rebellion. Monmouth's rebellion made King James very nervous. He saw the Scots Brigade as a hotbed of rebellion against him, and really, he wasn't wrong. So he ordered William of Orange to repatriate the Scots Brigade and to send all of the brigadiers back home, and William complied with the order. But he did so in stages. I mean, he couldn't just send them all home at once. They were occupying important border fortifications. He would have to move troops around, and that could take time, so it would take a little while to get it done. But don't worry, I'll send all of the important people home first. All of the, you know, rich people, the powerful people, the people who were loyal to King James. All of those fancy-pants cavaliers wooing damsels at twilight, that's who he sent home. The regular soldiers stuck around for a little while, and then, wouldn't you know it, William of Orange received an invitation to invade England. And wouldn't you know it, all of those common Scots brigadiers were more than happy to help him win that fight. In fact, the very first fighting of the Glorious Revolution involved the Scots Brigade. They call it the Wincanton Skirmish. On 20 November 1688, about 30 Scots brigadiers were out scouting for horses near the town of Wincanton, but they were spotted by a regiment of 130 Irish mounted infantry, loyal to King James. The two sides took positions behind earthen embankments and began shooting at one another, but the Irish just had the numbers, I mean, overwhelming fire superiority. But it turned out nonetheless to be a Scots victory. See, the local miller was a man who supported William of Orange, but he came rushing out of town toward the Irish embankment and told them that he had spotted a huge force of Dutch reinforcements heading to finish them off. This was a problem, so the Irish left. But of course, there was no Dutch force on the way. The miller was lying. In the meantime, all of those cavaliers that William had sent home were beginning to coalesce around Dundee up in Scotland. And you know, we know the story from there. There's the convention, Dundee boycotts the convention, Gene Simmons raises an army at Glenroy, and then Dundee arrives with his cavaliers. So now we've got two armies, one in Edinburgh, led by Hugh Mackay, and the other in Glenroy, led by Dundee. What's really interesting to me about these two armies is that just over a year earlier, the core of both of these armies had been members of the Scots Brigade. Now, what really worried Hugh Mackay was the threat of Dumbarton's regiment. Had Dumbarton sailed for Scotland and landed his army, he had the strength at this point to take Edinburgh. He could have, had he so wished, swept Mackay aside, taken the castle, and won the war in Scotland. But he didn't. Now, I'm not sure why, but again, I suspect Louis. I think that King Louis of France was holding him and his army back for service in Ireland. We know that the plan in the Williamite War over in Ireland was for King James to make kind of a beachhead, you know, a safe region for Louis to land a bunch of troops from which they would retake Ireland, then Scotland, then England. But that didn't happen either. Since Dumbarton wasn't going to land in Scotland, Hugh Mackay had the superior force there. Beyond that, he had the territorial advantage. He held the lowlands, and the rebels were just kind of stuck up in the hills. The highlands were just less valuable. However, they did offer a lot of tactical advantage, and Dundee had a plan. He decided that it would be, given his situation, best to bleed Mackay slowly. It started off as kind of a guerrilla campaign. Patrols sent out by Mackay's Williamite forces that ventured a little bit too far just disappeared. Supply trains were ambushed everywhere. Friendly villages and hamlets suddenly turned hostile for no apparent reason. It would be impossible to document all of these. We don't know about all of these attacks. They were really small time, but they kept happening over and over again. The book The Jacobites by Daniel Secchi has been a huge resource these past couple of episodes, and it's going to be even more important when the Jacobites lose their strictly pro-Stuart agenda and get into some weird ideas. Secchi writes, quote, "In May 1689, Dundee led his little army on its first raid into the lowlands. After a series of maneuvers, feints, and retreats over the next 2 months, he finally created an advantageous opportunity to attack the main Williamite force under Major General Hugh Mackay at the pass of Killcranky." End quote. We'll get to Killcranky. What was happening here, this guerrilla war, was psychological. The Williamite army was getting nipped at their heels. They were getting bled by 1,000 paper cuts. Nothing serious. They could absorb these losses, but it was demoralizing. Whenever they sent out patrols, their patrols were attacked and often disappeared. Whenever they sent out an army, they could find no trace whatsoever of the Highlanders. The Jacobite guerrillas just knew the land too well. They were too good at hiding their tracks. It was frustrating. And that's what Dundee was counting on. He wanted to frustrate Mackay. He wanted to make Mackay angry. He wanted Mackay angry and frustrated enough to march his army out in strength and hopefully make a mistake. But the morale of Dundee's forces was suffering as well. You know,
Taking out a few men on patrol may be psychologically damaging to the enemy, but it's not a great victory. So he needed to make a splash somewhere, something to keep spirits up. To that end, he sent a detachment under Patrick Stewart to occupy Blair Castle. And you can't see it, but I'm saying occupy with huge air quotes. Blair Castle was the ancestral home of John Murray, Marquis of Atholl. John Murray was a known Episcopalian and supporter of King James. However, when the tide began to turn in the convention, he turned as well. He voted for the Claim of Rights and for King William. This was viewed as a betrayal, and some of his contemporaries called him, quote, the falsest, the most fickle, the most pusillanimous of mankind, end quote. But Murray had a plan. He traveled down to London for his health, he said, and he was kind of sick, so maybe there's truth in that. But that also gave him a chance to ingratiate himself at the royal court, to make a big display of his loyalty to William and Mary. While he was away, his son had the command of Blair Castle, and as soon as Murray left, Captain Picard marched in and seized the castle. Sorry, Patrick Stewart marched in and seized the castle. And, you know, his son did fight valiantly in defense of his holdings, but the dastardly Jacobites just had a force too overwhelming to withstand, my liege. Still, not to worry. As we speak, his son was besieging the ramparts and had vowed to retake the castle in the name of his father and the king. But Murray's son was doing nothing of the sort. No siege was actually taking place, and it might look like a siege from afar. I mean, he did have a military camp set up outside the walls, but they weren't really doing anything. Which, of course, was all purely tactical. You see, Jacobite reinforcements were arriving on the scene in greater numbers every day. They were setting up their own rival camp just across the field. And if he were to attack to try to retake Blair Castle, Murray's son would be vulnerable from the rear. It's a real stalemate, my liege, and we're doing everything we can. But then, one day, the gates of Blair Castle opened. The garrison inside, the Jacobite forces, they marched out with trumpets blaring and drums thumping. They had their horsemen led by Patrick Stewart at the head of the column, by all appearances, ready to fight. And then across the field, all of those Jacobite reinforcements roused and were ready to move at a moment's notice. It was a tense moment, fraught with peril. So Murray's son gave the order. He donned his armor, he strapped on his sword, loaded his musket, and climbed on his horse. His standard-bearer raised the flag, and his army marched out of camp. But instead of marching to battle, he joined up with the Jacobites. It had all been nothing more than a ploy. This Jacobite force had had a few weeks of R&R there at Blair Castle, and now they were marching off with twice their original number ready to join Dundee and crush the Williamite army. It was a serious threat to Hugh Mackay and his forces. He really had no choice at this point. He had to move. If he stayed in a defensive position, it would be very probable he would be attacked from two sides and crushed. So he departed Edinburgh and headed off into the hills. And here he made that mistake that Dundee was praying he would make. Now, there are a lot of Scottish place names here that are old Gaelic names that I cannot pronounce and don't want to butcher as badly as I would if I tried, so I'm just going to avoid all of that and instead try to just describe the terrain. The Scottish Highlands are, you know, mountains. In between these mountains, there are lots of rivers and streams that create valleys. Some of those river valleys are wide enough to use for roadways, and those are the major arteries of transportation. Some of those valleys are really only passable if you're a native Highlander or, you know, a billy goat. Most of the waterways fall somewhere in the middle, much like the Pass of Kilcranky. The Pass of Kilcranky was not a broad avenue for an army to march down. It was a narrow walkway, lined with awkward dips and mounds and a small river. But an army could move through it. However, it would be a tight fit, and the ranks would be thinner than is usually preferred. What is about to happen comes down to what certain people thought about how to fight, as well as how those ideas would play out when actually implemented in a difficult terrain. Also, technology. Muskets were way better than they had been even just 10 years earlier. They were faster to load, faster to fire. Thanks to that advancement, the reliance on pikemen had fallen by the wayside. Instead, you would form up a line of musketeers, 3 to 5 deep usually, and they would fire in waves. The first line would fire, then the second, then the third, etc. That's how they did it in the wide open battlefields of the continent, anyway. That's how men like Hugh Mackay knew how to fight. But the Highlanders had a different way of fighting, an older way, and they were fighting on their home turf. On the morning of 27 July, 1689, Dundee raced to intercept Mackay at the Kilcranky Pass. If he could get there in time, he would be able to trap the Williamite army. It was unclear whether or not he was going to be able to do it. They arrived just after noon. But when they got there, Mackay had only just begun to enter the pass. The Highlanders had all the time in the world to get their men into place. Small companies of musketeers dotted the hillsides, hidden from view, but waiting. It was dusk when the Viscount Dundee decided that conditions were just right. Dundee and his horsemen charged into the mouth of the pass to engage the advance horsemen under Mackay. It pretty quickly devolved into a horseback melee, you know, punctuated by these splendid little duels, swords clashing. I'm sure it looked super cool, but the regular soldiers were kind of just stuck there behind the fighting. They couldn't advance because, you know, a bunch of guys on horses were trying to kill each other. And then there was an echoing cry all around the hollow, a Highland battle cry. From what I've been told, it sounded not unlike the rebel yell from the American Civil War. The Williamite commanders deployed their men at this cry on either side of the road in lines 3 men deep. There were some mounds and rocks that they could use for a little bit of cover, but not much. When the Highlanders showed themselves, the Williamites fired a volley. And the Williamite soldiers really were excellent shots. They hit a lot of Jacobites. Then, that first row having fired, they ducked down to reload their muskets. The second line prepared to fire, but as they found their targets, the Highlanders got their volley off. And the Highlanders had the high ground. So the Williamite forces down on the road, they took it hard. A lot of men got hit in that initial Highland volley. But those who were able to do so stood up and prepared to fire, but then, oh no, oh my God, the Highlanders, after they fired that first volley, dropped their muskets, drew their dirks and axes, and charged down the hillside. Now this wasn't normal. Usually, the two sides would exchange fire for a while before deciding to rush into a melee, but that's not what the Highlanders did. The Williamite musketeers, already prepared to fire, did so and took out quite a few of the Highlanders rushing down at them, but it wasn't nearly enough. In seconds, the Jacobites were going to crash into them, and here's the problem. In lieu of pikes, the English had adopted the bayonet. But instead of using a more modern socket bayonet, which could be affixed before battle, that looked, you know, kind of like the bayonets we use today, they used the plug bayonet. And the plug bayonet was just sort of jammed down the barrel of the gun. That means that you couldn't fire it when it was in place, which means you didn't put it in place until you needed to use it, which means you had to scramble to get it in place with a couple thousand angry Highlanders bearing down on you with their axes, which means that almost certainly you would fail to get it in place in time, which means that you got hacked to death with those axes. In the next few minutes, around 2,000 Williamite soldiers were killed. The river in the Pass of Kilcranky ran red. Only about 700 Highlanders were killed or wounded in the battle, and most of them were back on their feet before year's end. The Battle of Kilcranky had been a clear Jacobite victory. The Williamite forces had just been smashed. And it was undeniably a victory for the Stuart dynasty. But there was one death in this battle that mattered more than any other. James Graham, Viscount Dundee, was killed. Despite their smashing victory, over the following weeks his army just began to fall apart. The leadership was just nowhere near as strong as it had been under Dundee. You know, maybe if James Hamilton could suddenly appear and take command, maybe he could have mustered something, but he wasn't going to just magically appear. And that's what's usually attributed to the dissolution of this Jacobite army. But there was more to it than that. First of all, Ewan Cameron, well, he lived, but Clan Cameron had taken the brunt of those 700 casualties. They'd been in the thickest of the fighting. If they suffered another victory like that, Clan Cameron might not survive. Most of the warriors that Ewan Cameron brought to the table went home. There were also issues of supply. The Jacobites really needed to secure a safe line of supply. What they needed was a port in which supplies could arrive from the continent, but they just didn't have the siege weapons necessary to capture any of the ports in Scotland. So before long, they were hungry, bored, and most of them needed to get home before autumn. You know, they had farms to get to. The desertions started off slow, but began to pick up speed as the summer dragged on. By the end of August, there was no Jacobite army left in Scotland. Over in Ireland, James II had lost the Williamite War. The cause of the Stuarts looked hopeless. But the Jacobite cause was not yet dead. There were still those that held the torch, but over the coming years, they were going to have to change their tactics. The next major Jacobite uprising won't take place for the next 25 years, but when it does, it's going to involve acts of terrorism, and it's going to play a large role in the explosion of piracy at Nassau. Next time, we're going to talk about the English ship captain, Thomas Green, and his arrest and eventual execution for piracy. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who helps to support the show, all of our patrons on Patreon, everybody who has recommended this show, and everybody who has left us ratings or reviews. Without all of you, I couldn't do this. Thank you. The Pirate History Podcast is a member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you'd like to check out some of their other fine shows, like American Revolution Podcast, which shares some theming with what we've been talking about today, you can do so at airwavemedia.com. Our theme music was The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brithig. If you haven't checked them out, you can do so on Spotify, Bandcamp, YouTube, or wherever fine music is found. After you're done there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.